Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
Okay, I can't believe I get to say this, but my debut novel, Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire, just came out, and you all made it an instant New York Times, USA Today, and indie bestseller. And I don't entirely know what to do with that. I'm still getting used to hearing those words. I was at a book signing this past weekend, which is a thing I get to do now, and I never in my wildest dreams thought that would be my life. And they introduced me as New York Times bestselling author Don Martin. And I just don't think I'm ever going to get used to that. But Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire is not the only book I have coming out this year. I actually have another one coming out in November. It's my return to nonfiction. It's an audiobook with Simon & Schuster Audio called Where Did Everybody Go? And it's a deep dive into the loneliness epidemic that we keep hearing about. I talk to all sorts of experts in all sorts of fields, but one of those experts in one of those fields is my guest today. Sherry Phippen has been a city planner for decades. And if you don't know what a city planner is, well, you will by the end of this interview. But a city planner, surprisingly enough, has a lot to say about where we all live, how we live while we're there, and what we do while we're living there. I came in contact with Sherry while I was researching and writing Where Did Everybody Go? And we had an interview, and parts of it made it into the book. But I was like, gosh, there's so much more here from Sherry that I want people to be able to hear. So I invited her on my show. Here's Sherry Phippen. Sherry Phippen, welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sherry, this is not the first time we've spoken. I got to talk to you when I was doing the research for my upcoming audiobook with Simon Audio, Where Did Everybody Go? Which is this deep dive into the loneliness epidemic. And I was unprepared. I thought in my head, I had a whole outline for what that book was going to be and the direction that that research was, because I'd already done a ton of the research for this. But I got to a point in the research and writing and drafting of that book where I suddenly needed your expertise in a big way, because suddenly this book about loneliness took a left turn into zoning laws and how important an understanding of zoning laws are. And that's when you and I got connected. So for anybody who doesn't know you or your work, which is probably every single person listening, unless they happen to be directly related to you, Sherry, tell everybody who you are and what it is that you do.
So my name is Sherry Phippen. I currently live just north of Salt Lake City, Utah. For about the past 20 years, I've worked in local government, mostly in city planning. I, about a year and a half ago, jumped over to the private sector. So, of course, this is the part where I say my views don't necessarily reflect the views of my employer.
I've had Dan McClellan on the show before. The audience is well-versed in people who have jobs in Utah that do not align, whose personal beliefs do not align with their employer.
Yeah. So, largely, I've worked with smaller cities. Now, like I said, I'm on the private sector side of it. But for the first 15 years of my career, I worked with cities that have gone through the transition from largely agricultural to bedroom suburban type communities. So I've seen a lot of growth and change and the effects, good and rough, that it can have on cities and on individuals.
So I was so kind of fascinated to dive into the world of like what a city planner is and how, you know, the lives that we live are so impacted by that work. But for anybody that doesn't know what a city planner is, which that's kind of the whole conceit of this podcast, is talking to people in overlooked or misunderstood fields. What is a city planner? Like, what did you do for 20 years?
So a lot of times it's dictated by the size of the city the communities that I was lucky enough to work with and work for, primarily what I did was enforce and help refine the city code, the laws that govern how you can develop, where you can develop. So I did a lot of enforcement of existing regulations and making sure that developers or even somebody that just wanted six chickens in their backyard understood the framework that they had to operate within. Then there were also occasions, and sometimes if a city's staff is big enough, they'll have people dedicated just to this part of it, is to do more long-range planning where you look at, okay, we know that this area of the city is prime for growth. What do we want this area of the city to look like in the future? And do we want a park there? Are we going to need a school there? Where are we going to need additional roads? So there's kind of two sides of it. And I work, like I said, I worked with communities that were small enough that I did both. But a larger city is usually going to have people dedicated to each one of those.
You said something there that kind of, you know, makes my little brain tickle. How do you all kind of figure out so many years in advance that a specific area of the community is primed for growth? Because I feel like I see so many conversations, you know, online in communities about areas of cities, areas of the community that kind of get left out of conversations, and then areas that suddenly just seem to be, you know, out of nowhere developed, you know, into these. We have them here in, well, of course, we have a ton in Chicago, but I mean, there's all sorts of communities that were like, you know, this area had a lot of crime and drugs. And then now you cannot possibly afford to live there. Like, you know, so how did the city planner figure out this area is prime for growth?
It's really interesting. In Utah, a lot of times what'll dictate it is when a farmer gets ready to retire and his kids don't want to take it
home. Because there's like, so much
honestly,
land.
There is.
My husband is addicted to Yellowstone. Huh? I've seen that. I said, my husband's addicted to Yellowstone. I know what that conversation looks like. At least the fictional version of it. Yeah.
So some states, they are, well, let me back up. So there's this balance in any city between individual property rights and community property rights. And some states tend to weigh more heavily towards individual property rights. Utah is one of those. And so basically the way land use law in Utah operates at a state level, and that trickles down and informs city policies, Utah operates under the assumption that people have a fundamental right to do what they want with their private property, and any regulation that a city puts in place has to be viewed and measured in light of that fundamental right. And so what'll happen, you know, you'll get a farmer that his, like I started saying, his kids don't want to take over the land, or, you know, they have a developer that comes knocking and says, hey, we're going to give you way more money out of you for your land than what you're going to get to keep farming it. And so, like in Utah, that actually drives a lot of it, is one of those two things. And I mean, you can kind of see where a city is going to go just because of where the growth is. It's like you'll have growth up to a certain point and then you'll have a line. And it's like, oh, that must be where the property owners change. Mm-hmm. But, and so some of it is logic, just looking at growth patterns. But then there are sometimes something will come out of left field and you just kind of have to deal with it. And cities have generally zoned all of the property in their boundaries. And so they've kind of made a determination already. Okay, up here on the north side of the city, we're going to say you have to have a 1 acre lot because this is farther out on the city boundaries. And, you know, over here, more the interior of town or more towards a major road, we're going to say you can have apartments here. So the cities are required in Utah to have what's called a general plan and a future land use map. And that has basically the city's roadmap for what they want to have happen when a property owner decides to develop. So there's a few little different pieces to it.
I think people might be shocked. I know that I was kind of shocked to see how much of this is kind of determined and planned by the bureaucracy, which I know is like a bad word for a lot of people, but like the kind of those lifelong bureaucrats, the people that work in the gut, like the actual bureaucrats, the people that do the job every right. single day, and not necessarily the mayor, the governor, like the person who's right. elected. Their vision for where and how a community grows isn't necessarily as impactful as some of these longer term folks who are in these positions for much, much longer. You talked to me, and I would love for you to go into some detail here about kind of why private property rights are so sacrosanct in so many places in the country. So this kind of came up because in the conversation around loneliness, we are always idealizing the idea of like walkable communities, communities where I can come out of my house and I can easily access not just other people, but amenities, right? I can access my grocery store. I can get to business if I want. I can maybe get to work very easily. You know, walkable neighborhoods with cafes and grocery stores and all of that kind of thing. And those are pretty much disappearing from the, you know, American landscape, from the United States landscape. We are endless seas of houses divided by highways that connect us to endless seas of industry. And those spheres are getting ever more distant from one another. And you spent quite a bit of time talking to me about the fact that so much of that has to do with how protected private property rights are and why. So I'd love for you to go into some detail there for the listeners.
Yeah. So there's a few different things. If you go all the way back to, like, if you go back in Supreme Court cases, and I don't know if your research before you and I got connected looked into any of that, but I don't remember the exact year. There was a Supreme Court case that was, I think, Clyde versus Ohio. I'm going to have to remember. I'm having to go back to like my grad school reading. But, you know, years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that fundamentally cities can separate land uses. Like, it was kind of a health, safety, and welfare thing. Because, you know, people talk about you don't want to put a slaughterhouse next to an elementary school all of that, which is good. And so there's been some interesting jurisprudence that has evolved from the idea of fundamentally separating land uses, you know, and the Supreme Court in other cases has held that people can do what they want with their property. And any time that city, a state puts what's called an exaction on the property, it has to be in the interest of furthering a legitimate governmental purpose. And it has to be in like the least restrictive means possible to further that purpose. So that's like a little bit of the historical background on separating land uses and on how
and
the
sure,
idea has
I suppose
to
originally that things. makes total sense. Do I want a slaughterhouse right next to an elementary right. school? Probably not. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why not. You don't want a kid to get lost and accidentally become a hot dog.
No. And funnily enough, in one of the cities I worked for, there was a slaughterhouse and we had to have conversations around that. Anyways, so I think if you got into the politics behind, like, and I mean like the individual political preferences of communities where like private property rights are that sacrosanct, I think you would see a pretty clear divide between, you know, more to the right, Republican, ultra conservative, and wanting to protect those individual rights. And, you know, in community states, areas that tend to lean more towards community property rights, you'd see more of a Democratic, left leaning, more liberal political ideologies. And so I think that some of the idea of private property rights being so sacrosanct comes from individual interpretation of what our constitutional rights mean, whether they're all about.
Something else that we talked about at the time was that, I mean, it just comes down to like who is writing the laws oftentimes. you kind of clued me in that, you know, so much of our private property rights are enshrined in like state constitutions, local land use laws. So your state, your city, your county, those people are the folks who kind of are determining whether you've got those walkable neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of those private property rights, those laws are either being written by or supported by either people who directly run to get onto these boards or these, you know, elected institutions that are private property that are like housing developers themselves. So of course they then have a personal vested interest in it, or those people are telling those people are bankrolling the political aspirations of the folks who get onto these boards and get into these positions. Is that still holding true to your understanding?
That I can see, I would still believe that that's the case, because in a city, at any level of government, you have the three branches of government, just the same as you do at the federal level. You know, in a city, city council, town commission, whatever your political body is called, is the legislative body. They make the rules. And then your staff, and depending on the form of government, potentially the mayor, they're essentially the executive branch. So they administer the laws. And then you have some kind of like a prosecutor and appeals authority, that kind of thing. And that is your judicial branch. And so in every city and community, those three levels of government still function. And so it is really interesting to see the motivation behind why people choose to run for local elections. There will be some people that are very adamant that they run for an office to stop growth in the community. And that will be their platform, or it will be their platform to keep apartments out of their community, or something along those lines, which people a lot of times will be very successful at that. The tension comes in city planning when you've got the members of the legislative body that are enacting these laws or attempting to enact these laws or attempting to deny a development or something to that end, that as a staff member, you know, is in conflict with local laws, with state laws, with federal laws. And so there's this sort of balancing act within the bureaucracy of honoring the intent of the legislative branch for executive employees, but at the same time, knowing what your limits are as far as what you legally can do. You know, and we have an office in the state of Utah that helps take care of that. We have an ombudsman and a land use office and all that. But there's this really interesting tension because of exactly what you said, like, you know, looking at why people choose to run, and even in local elections, who's giving money behind it and who's donating and who are the outspoken residents and that get appointed to this or something like
that. One of the conversations that we had that I found hopeful was that this, I mean, this certainly sounds like, you know, capitalism coming into land use and, you know, we're just kind of doomed, right? You know, and that's what a lot of researchers kind of come away from this conversation. You know, oh God, we're doomed. We're just going to be an endless sea of houses here in the United States. And we're just going to get further and further away from community. And we're just doomed. But you were one of the first people that I came across in my research that really gave me like a sense of hope that all of this can be negotiated, all of this can be discussed, and there is light at the end of this tunnel. Like there's a lot of hope on the horizon in these spaces. So talk to me a little bit about, like, you've had instances where, you know, you've been in those rooms with, you know, local politicians or those housing developers or whatever who want to just continue, obviously, making their endless seas of houses because that makes them a lot of money, but they can be negotiated with. You can negotiate for community space. You can negotiate for park space. You can negotiate for a community center. Walk me through why a city planner cares about making space that doesn't necessarily sell, that doesn't necessarily make anybody any money, but two, how those negotiations take place at all. Like, what is it that you have on offer?
So to answer the first part of it on why a city planner would care or why, like, I would be invested in seeing them. You know, I think that fundamentally the responsibility of a city planner is not just to review a proposal and tell somebody what they have to do to build their 47 houses on 60 acres or whatever it is. But I believe that the fundamental job of a city planner is to create a sense of place, to create a community, not a city, not a suburb, but an actual community where people can choose to live, work, recreate, shop, do all of those things that we're seeing the research prove over and over is part of a healthy whole life, part of being a healthy whole person, getting out of the car, so, you know, as much as we can, interacting with our communities, knowing our neighbors. So for me, that's why I'm invested in that kind of thing. That's why I want to see more of that kind of thing happen, like that we create these whole communities, that we create third places, that we create these senses of belonging. Obviously, we can't force people to get to know their neighbors. We can't force people to go into the grocery store that's in the community. But if we're maximizing opportunities for people to engage and find a sense of purpose and belonging where they live, to me, that's the biggest reward of the part of a job, of any part of a job that I've had in city planning.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
I love that ethos of it because you're not just, you know, like you said, you're not just, you know, rubber stamping. Somebody comes to you and says, hey, I want to invest, you know, $7 billion in your community and make a whole bunch of houses and apartment complexes and stuff. It's also, you know, you're planning a place where people want to live, and people don't want to live somewhere that there isn't stuff to do and a community to exist in. People don't just want a place to keep their stuff. They also want a place to keep their spirit and to, you know, have a place to relax at the end of their day and have friends and family and all of that. And you can't have that if it's purely a capitalistic enterprise. So I really appreciate that kind of turn and focus on that.
I mean, I think as far as the different tools that you have at your disposal, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of calling somebody and saying, you know, hey, can you come in and sit down and we can talk about this? You know, in different cities are going to put different tools in place. Like they're going to have a master development agreement or something like that that says something like, okay, we're going to give you 10% more lots, you know, we're going to give you 60 instead of 55 if you'll set aside this acre and a half for a park, or we'll waive your building impact fees. You know, we'll waive some of the fees associated with permitting if you will build this facility for the community to rent out for art space, art classes, or, you know, to have a wedding reception or something like that. So there are different things that cities can do to negotiate stuff like that, to negotiate third spaces, to negotiate more open space. A lot of it depends on the relationship that you have with the developer. Some developers just want to come in and put up their cookie cutter houses and right off into the sunset. Some are more invested in the community as a whole. So as much as the public may think that cities are always in the back pocket of developers, like fundamentally that isn't the case that I've experienced. I can't say that that's never happened. I've been accused of it. And my response was, would you like to see my bank account? But, you know, it is, you have to have, as city staff, as a city planner, you have to have good relationships with developers.
Sure.
Or you will not get them to do anything extra that benefits the community.
So much of public work is unfortunately a series of concessions, and it's doing the most good that you can while holding on to all the pieces of your soul that you can.
Right. It's very true. I remember the day that I realized I had arrived in city planning, because in the same day, I was accused of being too friendly to developers and too hard on developers. Like, ooh.
Was that the same developer, maybe? Was it the same developer, just at different sides of the conversation?
I don't think so. Anyways, it was just kind of bizarre. But I'm like, oh, I must be doing something right if everybody's frustrated with me.
Something else that you walked me through that I had already been kind of looking at in this greater conversation around third places and where they are and how they're made and why or if they're disappearing or something like that. Also came up a conversation of the history of what is called redlining here in the United States. And you actually spoke quite beautifully about it as well as many of the other people that I interviewed. I'd love for you, for folks who've never heard of mortgage redlining, what is it and how is it still impacting communities today? And is there anything that a city planner can do about it?
To explain it very bluntly, but also very simply, redlining was a tool that was used to racially segregate cities. Off the top of my head, I cannot remember what year it peaked. I believe it was in the late 40s and 50s, but basically mortgage companies took a map of a city. The one that pops into my head is Denver, but I know it happened all over the place. But essentially, they took a map and drew a red line. And inside the, I don't remember if it was a circle or what it was, but they basically drew a red line on a map and said, on this side of the red line, we will give mortgages to white people. And on this side of the red line, we will give mortgages to everybody else.
Yeah, it was, and it was like literally written into the Federal Housing Administration code, like quite literally in the Federal Housing Administration.
It was federally codified racism. And it, I think, it sets cities back from what they could be hundreds of years, because, you know, instead of bringing people together for a place of shared community, shared experiences, shared culture, where they could learn from each other and create these mutually beneficial experiences within their neighborhoods, it's okay, well, you know, this community is just going to be here and they're going to have their culture. And, you know, whites are going to have their culture over here. And so it just perpetuated this idea of us versus them. And it, you know, sort of seeped into housing types. And then further, like, even the regulations within the types of mortgages that they would give to different racial groups, you know, it made it so that whites could get a bigger mortgage at a lower rate, afford nicer property, afford nicer homes, and it became cost prohibitive for minority communities. And so they a lot of them became house poor, and so they couldn't afford the necessary upkeep, because the redlined mortgage costs were so high that they couldn't afford the upkeep, the buildings would start to fall apart. And that's sort of how redlining, like, perpetuated what we call, what has been referred to, and I don't like either of these two terms particularly, are slums or that type of neighborhood. So it became this vicious circle that sort of kept people with a foot on their back with trying to ever get out of the cycle of poverty.
Well, and we see that today. I mean, we see, you know, there are certain politicians who speak to this today, and it's not a popular thing to discuss, but how areas that have specific historically been owned by people of color, Black people specifically, like, one, it of course impacts stuff like generational wealth. If your family could start owning property back when it was much more affordable, 50, 60, 80, right, 100 years ago, and that kind of wealth can be transferred on, you know, it impacts that, but it also impacts, like, the literal health of a community, because, you know, ecological racism is very much a thing. There are people, you know, there are places that do not have access to clean water, who are the areas where you know, new types of waste runoff is put, and, you know, they just don't have as many hospitals. Like, there's all sorts of problems with it that are still being dealt with today, that are still being felt by people today. And it all has to do, it all comes back to where people were allowed to live and what kind of communities were allowed to be built, you know, nearly a century ago.
Well, and I mean, that even gets into, and my apologies if you said this, like the physical condition of the building. You know, if people don't have money to fix their homes and like mold or other environmental toxins, they can't move out, they can't fix it. It keeps going and going.
And it's how we get stuff like food deserts. Like, it's just so many solvable problems here in the United States are just like, well, we really love racism. We love it so much. It's like baked into our, we just, gosh, it's a feature, not a bug. That's, we love it. It's special. Well, we just think it's neat.
It's a very, very uncomfortable truth for people to look at. In city planning, in American history classes, and all of that, because I think, and I don't think I'm being hyperbolic when I say this, I think redlining did more damage to communities as a whole than almost any other policy, decision, era. You know, I mean, I don't know that I would say that as fact, but it's a reasonably educated opinion. I don't think we can understate the amount of damage that redlining did to America as a whole.
And I mean, it all adds to this culture of fear that we're still feeling. I mean, it quite literally makes certain communities, certain groups, the other, because they right. live over there. They don't live next to us. So we are not mm-hmm. in community with them. We do not make them part of our in-groups. They remain part of our out-group, and thus we trust them less. And thus we want to be in community with them less. We don't want to make friends with them. Oh God, we're terrified of our children dating them or marrying them. Like, it just continues to create and perpetuate divide. How in the job of a city planner, obviously coming in and trying to navigate through that kind of history is a difficult thing. And obviously there's only so much that a person, you know, a bureaucrat can do. But are there instances where in the position of a city planner, you can try to stitch community back together or you know, right some of the wrongs that redlining does? Is there anything that modern day city planners can do to recreate or at least start trying to patch community back together?
I do. You know, I've heard it said that it's hard to hate somebody up close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously that's not always the case, but I think anything that cities can do, that city planners can do, to advocate for policies that bring people from a diverse economic or any socioeconomic group, anything that people can do to bring diverse groups closer to each other, as in the role of a city planner, bringing that closeness, I think that's what they should do. Obviously, one of the biggest things that comes to mind is the way we plan for future land use and grow. Like, if we're saying, okay, only single family houses over here, or apartments only over there, you're automatically creating the circumstances for othering. By separate, because there will be people who, for whatever reason, choose not to buy a house. I'm a single woman. Until 6 months ago, I did not want to buy a house. But yet, on certain economic factors, I met or exceeded that you would find in a traditional half acre, you know, white picket fence neighborhood. But I didn't, because it was just me, and because I have a full-time job and a career and want to go out and do all these other things, I chose to live in apartments. And then I found my perfect little house in this adorable little neighborhood. But one of the things that I love about my neighborhood is there is a mix of housing types. I live on a little U-shaped street that has townhomes. That is off of a street that is all single family housing. In the middle of all that single family housing is a giant park. And that was one of the biggest things that drew me to my little single level condo house with a dead backyard, but I'll get to that eventually.
Hey, if you just moved in 6 months ago, that's next year's problem. That's in the spring.
This year's problem is buying rugs and hanging stuff on walls. But I think one of a huge travesty is a separation of housing types in cities.
That's been a consistent through line that when I've talked to experts in all sorts of facets of this conversation of third places and city planning and state laws and all of that, is a lack of mixed use areas. Because once again, when people talk about, you know, that when people idealize walkable cities, they're not actually idealizing walkable cities. What they're actually idealizing are mixed use areas. Mixed use areas are, here's the convenience store and I live above the convenience store. And then there's an apartment complex right next to it. And then there's the little old lady that lives in the house across the street. And then down right from that is a park. Like, these are mixed use areas. This is stuff where you could have a barber shop next to a home, next to an apartment complex, next to an auto shop or something, you know, and there's no weird strict code as to what any right particular space could or should be. And we're seeing right a death of those because, you know, oh dear God. You know, one of the things that brought me to you is, you know, will we ever again see third places in new construction? And it's getting really difficult to say yet to find anywhere in the U.S. where the answer to that is yes. Because, my gosh, if you were to ever go, you know, some new family that moves in to some little, community and tell them, okay, so three houses down from you, instead of a house, they're going to put in a cafe or a bar. Everybody, you know, one of the granddaddies of the conversation around third places is a guy named Oldenburg. He wrote The Great Good Place. And in that, man alive, he idealizes the community bar, the town bar, where people, you know, everybody, when you talk about third places, everybody talks about Cheers as this like platonic ideal of a third place, which sure, on paper, in text, according to Oldenburg's 8 rules of what a third place is, Cheers is it. That's a third place. That's, you know, yada, yada. If you told somebody who moved into a new neighborhood that three houses down from them, they were going to build a bar instead of yet another cookie cutter house, people would riot. What, you mean alcohol?
They would.
Where kids could see? Children might see a bar? What?
What?
How dare you? Crime will come. There will be so much crime. Even though we all idealize Cheers, even though we all idealize, you know, the local pub as this platonic ideal of a third place, we don't actually want them in our own communities.
Right. I mean, it's the whole not in my backyard thing.
Yes.
We want
to love the idea of it over there for you over there. That's so nice for you over there.
It's really interesting because for years I've been fascinated with really small towns.
Me like too. I was from one.
That's right. Like the kind that you would see in the movie Cars. That's like these little towns that are fighting to survive, that are along this old highway that got replaced by the freeway. But one thing that's really fascinating talking about third places, and places that are trying to hold on to community and trying to hold on to identity, is in almost every one of these cities that I've seen, that I've stopped in, there is either a little diner or a gas station with a little grill inside where old men, and it is almost exclusively old men, gather every morning to talk about the events of the day, to talk about, you know, complain about whoever's in the White House, and have their coffee or their Pepsi. And it fascinates me that people crave the connection, but won't allow their cities to create it.
Yes, yes. Because if one, it's so many factors go into that. And the other thing is so many people get left out of those conversations of who right and how and what gets to create it. But yes, everybody wants it. The thing about a third place that I found in the research for the book is that you can't city plan them. That's one of the only things that like local government can't do, housing developers can't do. Yes, I could build you a park. I could build you a community center. But those things are not third places. Third places are where, just like what you said, a community naturally, organically comes together to meet and talk and let their hair down and, you know, get to know one another and keep the vibe right and all of that. Like, there's 8 codifiers of a third place. You can't plan for it. It's something that organically is created by the community. The problem that you have is whenever community is trying to create something and a zoning law or construction or something gets in the way of it. Suddenly, oh, well, no, you're not actually allowed to meet here or something. Ah, we know that you guys have been wanting to, you know, no, you love this coffee shop, but actually we need this to be a toll booth. Sorry.
Right.
So I'm curious how you bring communities in. One of the communities that is consistently the most lonely, that gets left out of every loneliness conversation. And I was both fascinated and also kind of like, well, yeah, that makes sense, is young people. No matter what era we're in, since we've been taking this data, whoever the current young people are, teenagers and young adults, those are the loneliest people. That is the loneliest age group because our society is not built for them. The only thing that we ever want from kids is that they are over there or out of the way. Children should be seen and not heard. But there are certain areas of the country where young people have been afforded a seat at the table, and it has actually been able to distinctly improve their own community building, their ability to see themselves in their community. One of the places that I talk about in the book is a place called the Parasite Skate Park, which is where young people just wanted a place to meet and skate. And they made one. You know, I'll go into depth with it in the book, and I don't want to take over the whole interview with it. But like, it's this fascinating thing of the positive stuff that can happen when young people are brought in. We see this in all sorts of communities. Right. We've talked about redlining earlier in the conversation. When people of color, when queer people, when disabled people, when young people, when people who are normally left out of these conversations are brought in to community planning, things get better for everybody because what's good for them is good for everyone. If their needs are met, everybody else's needs were already met. How can city planners either successfully incorporate voices that are left out of community building? How can they better do that? And what are some times in your own career that you've been able to kind of successfully get one of those wins for marginalized communities and city planning?
I think there's a few different things that cities can do. You know, anytime a city is going to undertake a large-scale planning project, whether it's a specific project on a piece of land, whether it's master planning for the city, whatever it is, cities will generally have like a public open house. Sometimes they'll have what's called a design charrette where people can actively engage and, you know, essentially play with Legos and say, okay, we want this here and this here. I think city planners, have to, when you're doing that kind of thing, when you're in the long range and medium range stage of planning, like, be intentional about involving youth and young adults. Set aside a specific time to have just that demographic come in and give them a blank slate and say, okay, if this was your city, what do you guys think? What would you guys do? Where would you put a park? What are gathering spaces looking like for you guys? They have to be taken seriously. I remember as a teenager going to help at a public event, and I was with a friend of mine. It was for Key Club or something like that in high school. And a local politician came up to my friend and I, and we were talking about something. But as soon as he learned that we couldn't vote, because neither of us were 18 yet, he walked off.
That's what keeps happening.
His interest in engaging with us was solely based on whether or not we had the power to vote. Kids, and I use that term very broadly, teenagers, youth under the age of 18, they have to know that their opinions are valued, that they are taken seriously, that their voice is needed as a city continues to grow, because those are the ones that are going to benefit or bear the burden of the decisions that a city council is making today. Because if a city is planning for 10 years, for sorry, not 10 years, for 20 years or 40 years down the road, you're not planning for the people that are sitting on the dais. You're planning for those people's kids, especially in somewhere like Utah, where I think it's somewhere around 70-75% of our growth as a state is native growth. Whether that's people having people that have lived there their whole life or people that grew up there, left and are coming back. And like I said, it's not the politicians that we're planning for. It's the next generation and the one after that. So their voices have to be heard at early stages.
Well, the other piece about that is it also models for them what community building looks like. Like, how to include everybody in a conversation. And I think one of the big problems that we see with young people becoming increasingly lonelier and increasingly more disconnected from others, you know, there's an issue with empathy. There's an issue with, you know, everybody's like, oh, every 13-year-old out there uses the hard R. And, you know, there's a lot of problems with the kids today and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of that, I think, has to do with the fact that we just simply are not modeling community building behaviors to them and with them.
Right.
We are not also teaching them that their voice and their opinion matters until they can vote, right? Suddenly we care what you have to say, but only a little bit because you probably don't have a lot of money yet. So we only care so much. You know, I want your vote, but you probably can't write me a big check. So, you know, I only care about you so much. I'll come back in another 15 years when you might have some money in your pocket.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting too, because some of the disengagement, some of the lack of connection, and this goes back to what we were talking about the first time we chatted, you know, even with the way we design our neighborhoods and, you know, our neighborhoods, our homes, they are not designed for connection. And this is the thing with garages.
Yes, I asked you. I was going to get that. I wanted to end the conversation with this, but I'm so glad we're there. I asked you, if you had a magic wand, what is the thing that you would do to instantly make community better? And you blew my mind. I'm not even kidding you. I texted everybody on my team. I was like, you are just never going to believe this answer. And it was just like I've had so many in-depth conversations with people about this. If you had a magic wand, Sherry Phippen, and you could change one thing about the way that we make communities, what would you do? And your answer was,
I would require garages to be recessed behind the front of the house.
It makes so much sense, because when the garage is in the front, like when the garage extends past the front door, we're entering and exiting our home through the garage. We're literally never into, like, you don't, we're not using our front. You were the first person. You said nobody uses their front door anymore. And I was like, no, I use my, wait, no, I don't. I don't even use my front door. It blew my mind. And that little moment of getting in and out of your car and walking to your door, coming in and out of your own front door, and like, maybe you wave to a neighbor. Maybe you smile and wave, or you get to see that somebody's kids are coming home or something like that. All of that is taken from us if we enter our homes through our garages.
If I was going to write a book about this kind of thing, it would be called The Death of the Front Door.
I want to read that book, Sherry. I hope you do. I hope you write that book.
I mean, the front door, the front porch, like, how many of us, you know, I'm late Gen X. I'm like the little micro generation that's a zennial.
Uh-huh.
I was born in the late 70s. And I would venture a guess that if you talk to most Gen X people, they can tell you about a house in the neighborhood or a friend's house or something like that, where they just had a front door that they could walk into. They would knock and walk in. Or maybe it was a door on the side of the house. Or there was like the knock and walk. And I think if you asked kids now, it would be very difficult to find a lot of people with that, and that have had that experience, that have that current experience now. I know people that won't even just walk in the front door of their parents' house. But I think that if we can bring back the importance of the front door, if we can bring back front porches or even just big stoops, you know, if we have an area to gather on our front porch, You know, I sit on, I don't have a big porch in my house. I just have a couple steps, but I sit out there at least a couple nights a week.
The front stoop and is is so many people's third place. That's what was wild to me is like in the research, the front stoop, the front steps are an important third place in many communities.
Right. Because you sit there and I mean, it's very cozy and air conditioned inside my house, but I want to sit outside because I want to see my neighbors come and go. I want to say hi. You know, I want the little kids that are playing soccer in the street to accidentally kick it into my front yard. But if we're not creating homes, if we're not creating spaces in the design of our homes, in the design of our subdivisions, where these things are happening, you can live in the same neighborhood for 30 years and never know your next door neighbors because you're driving into your garage, you're going into your house, and you know, you open your front door and cobwebs fall off.
Sherry, I want you to know, so by the time this episode comes out, we will have already moved into the house. But for anybody that doesn't know, we sold our house and we're moving. I need you to know that after our conversation, like last year, when I was house shopping, it was had that in my head. And the house that we're moving into, the garage is detached and it's behind the house.
It
has this beautiful big front door, the gorgeous, gorgeous all wood front door and this big covered front porch. And I can't even begin to tell you, my husband is about sick of me saying the words front porch to him and front door, because like, I was like, I've got big plans. I'm going to be on this front porch. I'm going to go in and out of my front door. I'm going to know. I'm so, like, it rocked my world because it's, people think that creating community are these big sweeping things, but conversations with people like you doing jobs like a city planner reminded me that like so much of building community is teeny tiny little things. It's going in your front door instead of going in your garage. It's taking that extra time when you're at your regular spot, your cafe or whatever, getting your morning coffee, literally saying hi to somebody. You know, we're losing words. That's a whole other thing. I wrote a whole book. I could dive down 87 different rabbit holes, but it's wild. It's wild. And what you do and what you've done is such important work. And I'm so glad that we get to spotlight you because I don't think people understand like the importance of a city planner. And in some places, I guess I just want to, because people might, you know, leave this episode and say, okay, I want to learn who my city planner is. City planners in lots of places they get their job differently. Some people are appointed and some people are elected. Is that right? I've got that right. A lot of places, you could be appointed by the mayor. You could be appointed by the city council. Some people run for this position.
I'm not familiar with anywhere that it's an elected thing.
Okay. So it's mostly an appointed thing?
No, mostly it's just a hired staff position.
Wow. Okay. So you really are just like going, air quotes administration, but like you really are just kind of like a lifer.
Right. I mean, and most planners will, you know, progress from like entry level stuff to being like a community development director. And, you know, there may be places where it's an appointed thing, but I'm not familiar with anyone that had to be appointed to their job.
Aren't you glad?
In Utah, there's only three, I think, city employees that have to be appointed. And again, that depends on the form of government, but like the city clerk or recorder has to be appointed. The city treasurer has to be appointed. And if you have the form of government where you have a day-to-day city manager or administrator, they have to be appointed. But and it's because those three have like bonding requirements and fiduciary duties. But most of the time, city planners, you go to school for it. Well, I didn't go to school for it. I got thrown into it. But you go to school for that kind of thing and then you just start and work your way up.
Well, Sherry, thank you so much for spending some time here and giving everybody just a little peek into the world of a job that impacts all of our lives, how we live our lives, where we live our lives, and So many people don't think about it. So many people put that responsibility, put that onus, put the role onto other people. You know, we talk to the mayor, we talk to the governor, we talk to the city council. And oftentimes it's none of those people. Oftentimes it's one of those lifelong bureaucrats who's just trying to do the very, very best they can with the very limited tools they have. But as you've shown us, you can do a lot with those tools. So I really appreciate it. Before I go, I do want to ask about the time that you were treated like Ron Jeremy.
Like what?
Like the time that you were treated like Ron Jeremy. We were talking about bars and that you, let's see, hold on, let me pull it back up. Okay, you were telling me about one of the first experiences as a city planner was telling a gas station that they could sell alcohol on Sunday and the various community reaction that you got to that.
Okay, so yeah, when I was an itty bitty baby city planner, I was working for a town in northern Utah, and there was a gas station being built. And it was a little bit already in progress when I started. So I dealt with them a little bit as they were going on, just to make sure they were following all the different conditions of their approval. And when they were getting ready to open, you know, I got a phone call that from whoever the store manager was going to be, or somebody from their corporate headquarters. And we needed to talk about their liquor license. And because every state, every city has weird liquor laws. There's some places you can't buy liquor on election day. Or you can't buy liquor between 2 in the morning and 8 in the morning. Or there's,
can't
there's
be drunk.
Always
Listen,
weird
if I'm awake at 4 a.m., I better have access to alcohol.
I know.
You better let me drink.
For me,
something's gone wrong.
For me, it's worse for Diet Coke.
There you go.
But as I was talking to this person about their liquor license, they said, now, I just want to make sure, because we've been told that it's a dry county, so we can't sell liquor anywhere. We can't sell liquor on Sunday. And so I looked into our city regulations for the type of liquor license they wanted. It didn't say anything about Sunday liquor sales being prohibited. So I said, well, you know, from my perspective, that's not an issue. You know, these are the times you can sell liquor. So go ahead and sell liquor on Sunday. I do not drink alcohol, but there was nothing in the regulations that said they couldn't sell it on Sunday. Word got out pretty quickly that I had done that. And I...
Sherry, oh my gosh.
I know.
Scandalous.
And I...
Kids might see Sherry.
Well, I... It was the dangest thing, Don. I got phone calls from members of the city council of the town I was working for. They wanted me to revoke it. I said, well, I can't do that. And they said, well, we don't want them selling liquor on Sunday. At that, before I did this, the closest place that you could buy liquor on Sunday was about 35 miles north across the border into Idaho.
Goodness.
And I was getting pressured to try and revoke it. And they said, well, I don't have the standing to do that. And they said, well, people are going to buy liquor here on Sunday now. And they're going to get in a car accident and kill my kid on the kid's way home from a church activity. And they said, well, the county has a rule against it. Because I got a phone call from the county, too. They said, we understand that you told gas station X that they could sell liquor on. And I said, well, it's not a rule in your rules either. And they looked into it and they said, oh, you're right. And they said, well, it's a state law. And I said, no, it's not. And so
it's just a vibe we've all been keeping for some reason.
It was like an urban myth. It was a, I don't know what it was, but no rule. And like I said, I am a very religious person who does not drink alcohol. But it wasn't up to my personal beliefs. It was up to the city regulations. So this gas station opened, and within 6 months, every other gas station in the county,
there you go,
was selling liquor on Sunday. And I mean, you can only, it's
I
still
do love
Utah.
The intellectual dishonesty of, well, if they're open on Sundays, people are going to drink and then they'll kill my kid. And it's like, don't kids go to school on like Monday? Like, aren't you worried more about going to and for like school buses and stuff? There's no school buses running on Sundays. Like, feels like a weird argument, a weird place to take it.
And the reality was, they're more likely not to drink if they're just going a mile and a half to the gas station,
right,
buying a 12-pack of beer. They'll go home and drink it instead of cracking one open on the way home from the store.
I don't want to be drunk at a gas station. I want to be intoxicated on my couch. I want to have my wine on my couch. I don't want to be at your gas station. I don't want to be at the Handy Mart drinking. I want to be on my couch. I want to be in my backyard drinking.
That was my first little rough bump as a city planner.
Sherry, you rebel, and you're revolutionizing the alcohol consumption in Northern Utah. Congratulations. Your legacy lives on. Congrats. Thank you. Sherry Phippen, thank you so much for being a guest on this podcast and also being one of my very favorite interviews that I did in the last year for my upcoming book, Where Did Everybody Go? I would tell you where you could find you, but you're not a public person. You're just a lady with a really cool job. So I will let people just love you from afar. Thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Sherry Phippen, who you can't go follow on social media because she's a normal person and not a weirdo like me that puts her whole life out there for everybody to consume. Links to be able to pre-order Where Did Everybody Go are going to be in the show notes below, or you could just go to any of your favorite audiobook purchasing apps or programs, or even request it at your library. Where Did Everybody Go will be out November 2025 from Simon & Schuster Audio. You could also go ahead and order Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire literally everywhere you get your books, an ebook, hardcover, and audiobook narrated by Jennifer Hale. If you want to hear more about how Jennifer Hale came to narrate that audiobook, that's the last episode. She was just here. Go just one episode down. Anyways, if you'd like to get more of me on social media for any reason, I am at By Don Martin, BYDONMARTIN. For some reason, people think my name is Biden. Like Joe, I guess. But no, it's By Don Martin. The website is also bydonmartin.com, which has information for all of the different things that I do and all of the places you can find me. I do have a Patreon where you can find early access to unedited, just full versions of all of my interviews at patreon.com/headonfire. Again, links to everything are going to be below. Thanks so much for listening. I'm going to go. But before I do, I just want to let you know to never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.